Session number 25921, real one.
Commander, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum sound archive. Could we start, please, with you telling me your full name, your date of birth, and your service number, if you know it?
I'm John Druce, sir. Druce being my mother's unmarried name, the Druce family. We're partners with Attlee. Druce is in Attlee in the City of London. I was born in Hong Kong on the 29th of October, 1920. My father being in the Hong Kong government, appointed, of course, by the colonial service. And he spent all his life in China in some way or other. Before going to Hong Kong, he was in Shanghai. And moved to Hong Kong, I think, and he fought in the First World War and was wounded. And he went straight out to Hong Kong at the end of the First World War, where I was born shortly after his arrival there. So what happens to me? Well, there were many fine organisations in England on a very much private net for looking after, quite frankly, the children of the Empire. And fortunately, my father, who was an Oxford Blue, one of his co-footballers was the Reverend Kenneth Hunt, who played for Wolverhampton Wanderers. And his sisters set up their own organisation for looking after children of the Empire in about 1925 or 24. So when my father turned to Kenneth Hunt and said, what am I going to do with these boys, because I have a brother older than me, he said, my sisters are set up for that. So we started going round what are called holiday homes, and these most devoted people of the Hunt family lived in Staffordshire, where else, close to Wolverhampton. And they had an old rectory, so I remember my brother called it being dumped there in 1925 when I was just 4 years old. It had no electric light, it had no running water, and it was full of children, which was absolutely marvellous. But even they couldn't cope with that building, and they moved into a much larger building called Woodhead Hall, which was owned by the famous Potteries family called Wedgwood. Now, that is a name to conjure with. And he let the house to this holiday home. Woodhead Hall was a magnificent building. It had electric light installed when we were there about 1926. And there must have been something like 20 children. During the so-called term time, they ran it as a school, very strictly. But on holidays, which would have really the standard system in the country, it became a holiday home, and it was tremendous fun. They had ponies in the stables. Of course, these big houses had stables. We had our own garden patch to keep. We had our own vegetables. But I do remember that in winter time, in Staffordshire, North Staffordshire, by the way, it was very cold. But we were all seen to be extremely happy. From there, I went to my prep school, my brother having gone a year before me, and my prep school was Homefield, Sutton, Surrey. Where are you now? Well, honestly, I don't know, but they're still alive. And why we were sent there is that my father's tutor at Queen's College, Oxford, was a Mr. Charles Wolford, and he had taken over this school in about 1921 or 22. And welcomed us as children of the Empire. There were only two other boys then, I think. And he was a most marvellous mentor. I think in the 5 years that I was there, never mind the date, it might have been 4 years, I only got beaten once, which is a record, I think. But he was a marvellous instructor, schoolmaster, in every possible way. He also was very fond of cricket. and I happened to be a left arm, and bowled everybody out that you can think of. And he promoted me to the Surrey County Cricket Club, because both my parents' home, which they settled in Wimbledon, but not until 1933, and Sutton in Surrey were both in Surrey. So I was nominated for Surrey County Cricket, who gave me a chance to join the club. And I enjoyed my prep school very much, largely because the discipline was very strict. Where did I go on holidays? Well, the first 30 years we went to the dear old holiday home in Staffordshire. And I can assure you that going by train in those days was a great thrill. And we would have been taken to Euston, poured on a train, and met at Stafford or Stoke-on-Trent, it didn't matter which one, by some car from the holiday home. And when you think of doing this three times a year, multiplied by two, because you went both ways, for 3 years, we really knew something about trains and the lifeblood to us. And the holiday home taught us how to mix. There were, I think, more girls than boys. Then I tried to enter the Navy for the Dartmouth entry, my father frantically signalling from Hong Kong, but I missed the key entry. Instead of having 6 months to prepare, I had 6 days and was rushed up to the Admiralty for an interview and failed to qualify for Dartmouth. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to go in the Navy. I had one uncle who became an Admiral, Sir Guy Sayre, another one, an uncle by marriage, Sir Lionel Sturdy. We chose very carefully in the family. But he, son of Sir Dobson Sturdy, winner of the first Falklands War in 1914, he decided to marry my father's sister. So she became, and he got a baronetcy out of it, so this was passed down to the son. He became Sir Lionel Sturdy and his wife Lady Dorothy. And their offspring was Elizabeth Sturdy, who has married Sir Edward Ashmore. So Edward Ashmore was sucked into the South. So that's how you know Sir Edward Ashmore. On my own educational front, I managed to get into Shrewsbury School. Not on a scholarship, I'm sorry to say, but by common entrance. And why was Shrewsbury School chosen, which is a good question, because most of my father and his uncle had been to Highgate, which was just up the hill from Wimbledon, but not far away. Well, the answer was that my father had fought in the trenches with the headmaster, Hardy. And when you're in the trenches, it must be rather like being in a squadron in the Air Force or the Navy. The friends you made there were going to be your friends forever. So my father got in touch with his friend, Hardy, who's now headmaster of Shrewsbury, and said, "Can you do anything for my boys?" He said, "Send them here." And that's absolutely true. So not only did I go with my elder brother to Shrewsbury, but my younger brother came there as well. So I have a great affection for Shrewsbury School, which I maintain to this day and keep in close touch with the school and attend their functions. And I've added to my laurel leaves by sending my two grandsons who went there this term, grandsons who are sires of my second son. So I've now got two grandsons at Shrewsbury, so you might say my life is complete. How about that? Now, during the war, I had trouble being a swordfish pilot with the Germans, who fired at me rather rudely when I attacked a convoy off the Dutch coast. Unfortunately, the carrier we were expected to go to in 1942 had been sunk.
Well, can we come? We'll come on to that after you've left Shrewsbury, if we may.
Yes.
So you're
leaving Shrewsbury.
Yes, you're coming towards the end of Shrewsbury. You're 18. It's 1938.
Yes.
Munich is on the horizon and worse things. What were your thoughts at that time?
Well, I had, fortunately, my father, as friends, were pretty carefully picked, and one of them was head of the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, and another than somebody, Graben, I think it was his name, whose daughter I rather fancied at the age of 14, who now lives down here, but that's beside the point. So I got a nomination which was necessary for the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. So I ground away, I left school, got my school certificate, and ground away at a crammer's to pass the Bankers Institute exam, which there were various organisations in London set up for just for that purpose. In the middle of this, of course, the war started. And the famous Sir Lionel Sturdivant was re-employed to help the Royal Air Force recruit their pilots from Cambridge University. And he saw the RAF was doing this and took a sounding and discovered that the Navy was about to do the same thing. How about it? Yes, I said. So I dropped the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank and applied to be a pilot in the Royal Navy. And I think I got in without much difficulty because I got in and went to the training establishment in Portsmouth, St. Vincent, which was the boys' training establishment, in 1940, summer thereof, and started to train as a pilot.
Why did you think you got in without much difficulty?
So I think the more people required than there was demand for, and I didn't think the entry requirements were particularly stringent. Mark, at me, when they moved it down from graduates, of course, to whatever they call it, school certificates, two or three subjects, was when it caught me up, you see. So they must have been searching this field. And indeed, when I went to start flying training, I had Etonians, Arabians, and goodness knows what, in exactly the same place as me, training to be pilots in the Fleet Air. I see the point of what you say. I got the impression that they were pretty glad to have us. I don't know what the supply was after I entered. Now, mine was number 18 by the Scots at St. Vincent in the summer of 1940. And I actually did my flying trip. We did my naval training in Portsmouth. And then we did our flying training under the auspices of the Royal Air Force, because they are responsible for all flying training, ever you thought you were going to be. They shipped me out to Canada for it, a marvellous experience, of course, at that age, 18 or 19, to go somewhere in the Commonwealth. This was called the Empire Air Training Scheme, and my brother, who entered the Air Force at the same time, was shipped off to South Africa, and he became a liberator pilot. So I did my flying training in Canada. It was a marvellous experience. We did our training by night and by day for 4 months. It's quite amazing. This is in January, February, March, April. By this time it was 41. That we got through our flying training program, because the weather was pretty good out there, except when it snowed. And one or two of our aircraft were lost in snowstorms, but the crews got away with it all right. But the experience there and the intensity of the flying was what you desperately needed. And we were, so I was back in England.
Before we leave Canada, if we may, was there, I have heard stories sometimes that there was quite a high casualty rate among trainee air crew.
Well, I don't know. I went to Kingston, Ontario, where there was an aerodrome. On my pilot's course, there were actually 4 RAF candidates, and the other 30 or so were all Navy. So I didn't hear of this. My brother, as I said, had gone to South Africa to George. And I wasn't aware of that. Certainly the training was very intense, indeed, but I thought excellent instructors. I mean, my own instructor came from Nigeria, where he already had a pilot's license. And I imagine he was snapped up by the Royal Air Force. I mean, he was quite a bit older than us. he would have been 25 or something like that. He was snapped up offering to come to England to fly, and he was snapped up with them for instructing, and he was very, very good indeed. That's all I can say. And we passed out flying in Harvards and fairy battles at Soho and converts. Where's that photograph, Molly? Never mind. And I thought it was very good because it was very intense. We didn't hang around. We arrived on Christmas Eve.
1940.
And if you can imagine that. And in Canada, they had no blackout. They had massive food, and the war hadn't touched them. But we got very good coverage in the local press because they said, I can remember, at last we are doing something. That was a Canadian press reaction. I've got the cuttings somewhere and a few photographs. And we felt we were doing it because we flew under training by night and for day. I said 3 months, I think it was 4. Spread it around. So that's what I remember for them. There was very little social life, but I did meet a girl who was very nice. And Molly knows all about her. Her father was a professor at Kingston University. Very careful who we picked, we said. that's really the sum of it. As far as the closest we got to it was our final dance. We danced, nothing more. And that's my story of Kingston's. I remember it was all flying and intensive instructions, which is what we needed. And we got back to England in the steamer. I remember its name. It was called the Sir Cassio's, Earl Blue Funnel owner. But we had been given our commissions on finishing our training. But they hadn't got any accommodation on this ship for officers. And there wouldn't be another ship for 6 weeks. So as a man, we said, we'll come as sailors. So, of course, we lived and worked with the sailors. It was an armed merchant cruiser, quite a familiar ship around the time, as sailors, and got back to England 6 weeks earlier. And I went to Leon Solent, which was a great base for a pilot, where the flag officer and naval air command was based. And there was a telegram to me, appointing me as sub-lieutenant, and to report to the naval air station, Crail. Do you know where Crail is?
No, I don't, no.
It's in north of Scotland. The day before yesterday. So I hurried up to get advice from my uncle, who said, you catch a train to Edinburgh. And I caught a train to Edinburgh that night and changed train, arrived at Crail 2 days late with a half a dozen other, and started my naval operational flying training, which was to drop torpedoes. I was selected for torpedo dropping rather than for the fighters who went to Yeovilton down here.
Why was that?
Why was what?
Why were you selected for torpedo attack?
Rather than the fighter.
Yes.
Well, I think it's a result of the flying training reports that were sent in from the flying training establishment in Canada. And who was... I rather think people were selected to be pilots, judging by the ones that I knew, were academically very much better, and therefore they exercised better judgment, perhaps. And the training at the fighter school, no doubt, was more intensive. The flying training for dropping torpedoes was pretty straightforward stuff. That's a guesswork, if anyone hears that. I think they would agree to it. Certainly the brighter pilots, as far as we were concerned, were selected to be fighters. And fortunately my particular friends, were selected to be TBRs, which calls them, to be the bomber reconnaissance. The flying training was at Crail, near St Andrews in Scotland, and it so happened, unbeknown to me at the time, was where my future, now present wife, lived. And our social contact was with St Andrews University, and also for entertainment, such as it was the only place we had to go to. And I soon met with her, because fortunately one of the girls at her finishing school, which actually was in Perthshire, was the brother of one of the pilots on my course. So we were a natural to get together. And then from Arbres, from Crail, we'd finished our torpedo on the Swordfish and Albacore, just by night and by day. We then went to Arbres, the Royal Naval Air Station Arbres, which incidentally was taken over by a Marine, Romans without training, about 20 years ago. And Arbres was intensive deck landing training. Intensive, night and day deck landing training on the aerodrome.
So you pretend that part of the runway is a ship's...
was a ship's deck, and it was lit accordingly. And you had lots of lights and things like that. We also did a fair amount of navigation by night, just local flying navigation. Not out at sea, but just up and down the coast. But it was intensive deck landing training. It went on for 6 weeks. And from there we eagerly awaited our appointments to first flying squadron. Two of us went to Arkroyal, where they were promptly sunk. Those were particularly friends of mine. I was appointed with one other officer to join a squadron at Leon Solent. The number of the squadron was 811, and I can talk a lot about 811. In fact, I've written a book about it. At Leon Solent, and we were armed with American aircraft. The Chesapeake 2, not the Chesapeake 1. What was the difference? Chesapeake 1 had a fixed undercarriage. Chesapeake 2 had a folding undercarriage, which was also incorporated the dive breeze. And I've just written to the Fleet Aero Association magazine saying we were formed as a dive bomber squadron, because somebody had written to say just last week that there were never any dive bomber squadrons in the Royal Navy. So I've corrected all that. So I went to 811 at Leon 7. Chesapeake, beautiful little aeroplane, slightly underpowered. It also had four forward-firing guns. It was no doubt intended by the American Navy to be a fighter as well. But it wasn't very good at this. It had a height ceiling. It was a radial engine. It had a height ceiling. And it was a beautiful aeroplane to fly. Plenty of room for me in it. I'm 6'5". And a very good view, etc. And beautiful for dive bombing. And you put your wheels down, and there was your dive running. You automatically went straight into a 60-degree dive. Very disappointed when they were withdrawn from service. And we were re-equipped with soldiers.
Well, this is a question I was going to ask. You've done torpedo bombing reconnaissance training.
Yes.
And deck landing training, and then you're given an aircraft that is entirely a dive bomber. That would have involved further training and a movement away from what you had been doing, or not?
It's only a slight movement. I think that the fighters training went to Harvard's, and it looked just like a Harvard anyway, the Chesapeake 2 did. So it wasn't all that different. It was in many ways an easier plane, a more understandable plane to fly than a Swordfish, which was very slow indeed, and you couldn't get the darn thing down sometimes in a strong wind. Whereas this thing landed beautifully. And we had, it was a grass aerodrome at Leon Sound, and you could put this thing down very comfortably. So, although it was a dive bomber and apparently a fighter, it was a beautiful, light and easy plane to fly.
I'm really done, Morris.
Yes. Yes, please continue. I'm sorry.
So, I've come to the point where we were... at our appointment, on the completion of our training, two of my course, for example, went to Arkroyal, but I was appointed to this Chesapeake, which is a dive bomber squadron, and I've recently had to correct the Fleet Aero Officers Association.
Yes.
Because we were formed as a dive bomber. I believe that the strategy behind it was because this was during the invasion scare period, that somebody somewhere had said dive bombers were the things you wanted to attack invasion barges and goodness knows what. Initial training at Leon Solent in the art of dive bombing, and a marvellous little aeroplane it was, because by selecting undercarriage down, they were also the dive breaks. And that action put the aircraft into a 60-degree dive. And when you think you'd be close enough, you lifted your undercarriage and the plane automatically pulled out, assuming you've left enough ground underneath. And then, rather sadly, we were sent off to Scotland and been told we were going to be re-equipped with assault fish, and we flew our airplanes up to Arbroath and turned them over there to store it. And I discovered from an observer that the presence of this Scotch and this type of aircraft seriously concerned the observer corps. Even
yes, we are.
And we were re-equipped with swordfish at Arbroath, where we, as a squadron, we worked as a squadron on a number of torpedo attacks, a lot of night flying navigation exercises, and we were eagerly awaiting our carrier, which was HMS Archer. However, she got delayed either by the enemy or by breaking or a torpedo, submarines, and didn't appear. We did our deck landing training in the Argus, in the Clyde, and then we heard that we were going to be sent to HMS Biter, escort carrier, which was very exciting indeed. We had been under training for a long time and we were frankly getting bored. But we had a very good captain at Arbroath called Mallinson, ex-Royal Air Force and very well known decorated officer from the Royal Air Force, who spotted that unless we got off into action soon, we were going to make some stupid mistake of over-enthusiasm, and we did. On the cooperative exercise, two of our aircraft flew into a hillside. And he said, you must be got on operations as soon as possible. And our carrier, although it was on its way, hadn't arrived, so we were lent to the Royal Air Force to attack German convoys in the North Sea when they dared to appear. But more, almost every week for the next 6 or 8 weeks, we mined the Dutch, Belgian, and French ports.
You mined them from a swordfish?
From a swordfish. We carried one mine.
Obviously underneath it in some way.
It looked like a torpedo.
Oh, I see.
They were a special aircraft mine. And we did it all by night. And I personally mined the entrance to the... my geography's gone mad, but it's in amongst the Dutch islands. I think it's the Elbe. The entrance to that. Well, we knew from reconnaissance U-boats were housing. We also manned Ostend, outside the entrances. And what's the big port where they kept the big ships further south? It'll come back to me. Where are the big liners? Liners berth.
At Cherbourg. Oh, Cherbourg.
On one of the operations, I simply ran out of petrol because of bad flying. I went into override to attack the German convoy, and they had balloons flying. We had to maneuver very quickly, so I went to. I forgot all about this until I turned home, and I'd used 1 hour's petrol in about 10 or 15 minutes. So before I got home, as we were over England, the fan stopped. And I landed in the field, which is all very exciting. I damaged the aircraft, but not the crew. And my brilliant air gunner had sent out a mayday. And we were quickly picked up. Now, that was very exciting. All in complete darkness.
I was going to ask you, how did you, in complete darkness, with fairly primitive aircraft, how did you navigate? And how did you know where you were?
Well, we'd come over the coast, you could see that clearly, and we were at 3,000 feet. And after flying for 5 hours in darkness, you can see surprisingly well. you can. And I could see the difference between black and white down below, or woods and cornfields, and Norfolk is just one big solid cornfield.
When
we were on a beam, I should say this, if it's your particular question, there was a beam from our base, Bertram Newton, and the beam was sending out BN. And as long as you kept down this beam, it reached 100 miles into the North Sea. And we picked it up at 100 miles. You may say, well, that's fine, but 100 miles is 1 hour's flying. And we just came in on this beam. And if I'd have gone on, I would have landed at Bertram Newton, but in fact the fan stopped before I got there. And I put it down the field because I could see that it was a cornfield. And I did have a very bright landing light, which you put on just